I ended up coming back to Los Angeles and picked up where I left off, and going to concerts, hanging out with the Screamers and my old friends, and the scene had grown and grown. There was a lot more bands, and you know, there was still like concerts every night to go to. There was probably most nights of the week there was out of town concert happening. I was in line waiting to see Para Ubu, and there was this guy I'd seen at a million concerts, at every concert, and he had a big Deborah Harry badge on and bleach blonde hair and a white vinyl trench coat with belted really tight at the waist and white girls' cowboy boots on. And I thought, like, wow, who's this completely strange creature? And so I started talking to him. I think we were probably drinking out in line, because this was another time in space when you could do things like that. And he turned out to be Jeffrey Lee Pierce. I found out that was his name. And he had a band called The Red Lights, but he really wanted to start a different kind of band. So we got to talking and got drunk, and we, you know, knew we were a big I think I had seen him at the television concert the week before, you know, and we were like rammed up right in front of the stage. And so we started talking about music and drinking and getting around. I found out that he'd been traveling a lot too, and had been to New York, and he'd actually gone to Jamaica. He was writing reggae reviews for Slash magazine, and you know, he had we had a kind of a travel wanderlust thing about us, so we talked about traveling a lot. And so at the end of our conversation, he said, like, well, you should be in a band with me. And I was like, well, you know, I don't do anything. You know, I don't play any instruments. And he's like, well, then you could be the singer. And I thought, like, no, I definitely do not want to be the singer. So he's like, okay, I'll be the singer and you can be the guitar player. I was like, well, I don't have a guitar or play guitar. He's like, I have an extra guitar and I'll teach you how to play. So I was like, well, you know, okay. You know, and I thought, like, why not, you know? Because we talked about, like, we'd seen other things than just the local bands, and that we had actually been influenced by a lot of outside things, by the British scene and the No Wave New York scene and traveling and him and reggae. And, you know, it didn't really matter if we didn't really know what we were doing. That was not ever a consideration in those days for a band. And so we started to, he gave me a Bo Diddley record and told me to listen to the Slits album, and showed me how blues players played. He said, like, well, because I was trying to learn chords and it was just like impossible for me. So he's like, well, you can learn really fast, because what blues players do is they tune their guitar to an open E, he said, and play slide. And so, and I like slide because I really was a big fan of Lydia Lunch and Pat Place of the Contortions. So I thought, okay, well, this makes sense. So we recruited some friends of ours, a really good friend of ours named Brad Dunning, who's actually a really big interior designer now. And another, a journalist friend of ours named Don Snowden, who wrote for the reviews for the New York Times. And so we were all just like, you know, some guys, you know, and we started to hammer out some really quite horrible noise. I remember one of the first songs we learned was a version of Winston Rodney, Burning Spear, of People Get Ready, his version of that. And then we played, My Brand of Blues by Marvin Rainwater, and Bo Diddley's a Gunslinger, and those were kind of the first songs we learned, and some original songs, because Jeffrey was already writing songs, and we hammered out some kind of weird sound that kind of was a pre-Gun Club. Then we had a band called we called our band The Creeping Ritual, and we quickly played a live gig that I think the Blasters gave to us, or maybe Keith Morris of the Circle Jerks, I can't remember, but I remember our first gig was at the Hong Kong Cafe in Chinatown, in Chinatown, and we were really terrible. This was probably like 1979-ish, we're getting towards the end of 1979 when we played our first show at the Hong Kong Cafe in Chinatown in Los Angeles. And we did our noisy, gothy, reggae, blues collaboration. And the people in bands really loved it, but I think the audience really hated it. And Jeffrey was quite obnoxious already at the time. He was already enfant terrible. And soon after that, we decided, Keith Morris said, you need a different kind of name because that name is too gothic sounding. And so he offered us the name of the Gun Club. And Jeffrey actually traded him a song for it, a song called Group Sex, which became the title song of the Circle Jerks album. So that was the genesis of that name. So then we ended up calling our band the Gun Club, and Brad was getting too tired when he was playing drums and throwing his sticks in the air. So he decided he didn't want to play drums for real. And Don was too busy writing or something. I can't remember what. And so we decided like to continue on, and we recruited some of the people that did like us that were in the audience were the guys from the Bags, and that was Terry Graham, the drummer, and the bass player. So it was kind of Rob Ritter, and so that kind of came as a package deal. And they said, "Oh, we'll play with you." And so we started rehearsing, and me and Jeffrey started writing more original songs. And they were really good players. And we were like, oh my God, they can really play, because we'd been playing with people who couldn't play. So Jeffrey gave me this tape of like songs that he gave the band a tape of like songs he was interested to influence the band. And that was a tape that had like different things like Bo Diddley on it. And, Marvin Rainwater, My Brand of Blues, Marty Robbins, Murder Ballads on it, old Little Richard, some blues stuff, and that kind of really more solidified where the direction of the band would go. And so we, did our homework and listened to these records and, started, just making it. It was kind of a very natural thing. It just kind of came about that way. It wasn't a huge calculate. I mean, that was as calculating as it was the influence. Oh, yeah, I remember Bob Dylan was on that tape. Tombstone Blues. That was like a big, that was like one of the very first Gun Club cover versions we did was a version of Tombstone Blues. And you can completely see that influence in that first album. So, like, from doing things like Tombstone Blue and writing our blues in our own songs, Sex Beat was a really first one. And that was, kind of a garage rocker sort of thing. That was a very punk kind of song that doesn't really have much to do with, has much more to do with a soul song than it does with a, than with a country-ish song. But then, like, blues, like Preaching the Blues, we did really early on, and that, was a big turning point in the Gun Club sound, was like learning how to do that, because that was half, pretty much improvised songs. And that was, I think, where I get my singers, guitarist like leanings, was that that was a song that totally just depended on a beat going, and the changes come when the vocal comes. And when the vocal line comes is whenever it comes. It doesn't come when it's supposed to come. So it's like following what's going on. And that was kind of my first, dealings with improvisation too, because that was the always was, even till later days in playing it in the Gun Club in the last days. It was always a completely improvised song because, we didn't know where the parts were going to come and how long Jeffrey might draw it out, or if we were going to freak out, or if we were going to stay cool. That was a huge turning point in what the sound, what could sound, and it kind of showed us what we could do, and kind of shocked and surprised us, And so we actually could employ that more in songwriting. That theory, And to us, it was like, oh, that's like a Patti Smith, that's like, following what's going on in improvisation. So yeah, Jack on Fire, she's like heroin to me. Railroad Bill, For the Love, Ivy, are all really early songs, you know, that were pre-Fire of Love that I played on that, and, you know, helped write. And, you know, we were, you know, really hitting our stride there. And what came out of it was having these punk rock players play with us who could really play. And Jeffrey could actually really play, and they could actually really write songs. And I remember people thought his singing was some horrible howling. Even after we made records, they thought that. But he started to really find that voice that, you know, came, you know, into what the Gun Club became. And it was, you know, we were like super irreverent. We were super nihilistic. We were super half like hating that music and trying to destroy it, and half really loving it and trying to make some new voice out of that. Jeffrey was getting very into this like preacher man persona, you know, very Night of the Hunter, you know, bad preacher thing. And he was kind of getting very into that. And we even were banned from playing at the Club ADA because they were so horrified that he took a Bible on stage and threw it on the ground and danced on top of it. And, you know, like, you know, it sounds totally silly to me now, but like, and it was kind of just funny to us then. But people were actually really offended by, like, club owners were offended by us. And that was very fine by us because we were like really wanted to be offensive, and we really wanted bad vibes. And, you know, we really, we're into the bad juju, you know. We really were, you know, big Dr. John fans, and, you know, we were really nihilistic, you know. That was what, you know, we wanted. We were out to destroy music as much as we were to create it. Jeffrey was a very odd sort of boy. He was very obnoxious all the time, but very sweet too. It was kind of a strange thing. I forget, someone wrote, be like, and it's very true, you would want to get you to the point where you wanted to strangle him and throttle him, but then he would do something that would charm you so much that you would end up forgiving him for it. It was kind of one of those things where the band would be playing and he would be being so obnoxious on stage, like, berating the audience and telling everyone to fuck off and to, you know, and what losers they were, and, you know, and you'd be laughing, and then it would go on and on and on, and this would be in the middle of a song, like in the middle of Preaching the Blues or something, where we're all just like still going na 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 na, you know, waiting for the change to come, but it can't come till he gives the signal, and he's, you know, telling everyone they're butt fuckers, and, you know, and the audience is all walking out. The five people in the audience are walking out. And then he would say something just so hysterical. And then, or he'd come back on the song and like do some brilliant phrasing and crack the song, and we'd like all like fall back in, and it would be like completely magical. And then you'd be like, okay, well, maybe he is great, you know, maybe it is great, you know, that's the kind of things, you know. And it's funny because like years later I was playing with Nick Cave, and we played a festival somewhere in Europe with the Pogues, and Shane McGowan was so off his face, surprise, and but like I was like standing in the wings watching, you know, from that, and all of the band had their back to the audience, like, and we're like just like cursing him out, and like, and he was just like somewhere, the microphone was here and he couldn't find the microphone, and, you know, he was just like this. And then the band just, you could tell, wanted to kill him. And then he would like go up to the microphone and like this, sing this a completely brilliant sad ballad, and everyone would be like, oh, you know. And it was just like, but he really reminds me of like Jeffrey really a lot, you know, that really. And it was like that kind of thing with Jeffrey. So we were like playing a lot of live shows, and, you know, one of our big hits was our song For the Love of Ivy, because everyone knew that like we were singing about Ivy from the Cramps. And I made up the first set of lyrics, which were, things I took out of a book we had called 1001 Insults. And it was just like this, like, because the song, you know, although it turned into a tribute to Ivy, was not always really that. It was just a good title because we liked the Sidney Poitier film called For the Love of Ivy. And so it was 1001 Insults. And I can't remember what all the insults were, but it was really, really funny and really scathing song. And then we decided just to change it to use some very blues imagery and steal different blues lines and different scathing blues lines, you know, kind of more metamorphosized into that. And then it became more of a, you know, our tribute to hunting down Ivy because we wanted to, you know, have sex with her. So that was the time, you know, we were playing still out to, you know, 10 people from other bands that would show up to see us. And the Cramps had actually moved to town, to Los Angeles. You know, Brian Gregory had quit and they had a fill-in guitar player for a while and they weren't happy with her. And they were just, you know, I think scouting around for someone to play with them. And they came and saw the Gun Club and really loved it and flipped out. And Dave Alvin of the Blaster tells a story that Lux and Ivy were there with a cassette tape recorder and taking notes at our local shows. And one day at the advice, I think, of Christian Hoffman of the Mumps, he said, like, why don't you get Kid Congo, you know, Brian Tristan to play, the guy from the Gun Club, that, you know, that boy that hangs around and pesters you all the time. And they called me up and asked if I'd, you know, come and play with them. And I was said, like, well, you know, I have a band and I was going to college to taking journalism, rock, you know, journalism and Spanish and typing lessons. And they asked me to be in their band. And so I said, well, let me consider this for a moment. And I asked them, well, do you want me to audition? And they said, no. And they said, I said, well, what do you want to know? And they said, well, what are you willing to sacrifice? And I said, well, like my band or my school or moving somewhere or something. And they said, no, like a finger or something. And I said, well, let me take this under consideration. And so I thought about it and I went to Jeffrey and I said, well, the Cramps just asked me to be in their band. What should I do? You know, and we have this band and it's going well and everything. And he's like, are you crazy? He's like, in the Cramps, you know, because to us, we were playing to 10 people, you know. And when he's like, no, you know, that's an incredible thing. You know, it would be great. You know, you should do it. He said, I would do it in 1 minute. I called him up and I said, yeah, that was that.